Welcome to another Facebook Live interview with Bermuda's Movers and Shakers, and I'm Don Burgess. Today I'm with Scott Pierman, who's the Shadow Minister for Legal Affairs. Welcome, Scott.
Good afternoon, Don. Good afternoon, Bermuda.
Scott, why don't we start with why you got into politics? You've been an MP for about half a year now. What made you decide to make this an interest of yours?
Well, I've just hit the six-month milestone. I was elected in the by-election in June. I first got involved in politics just before the OBA won the election, when Craig Cannonier became the leader of the party. And I thought that it would be an opportunity for me to try and make a difference on the island and to try and make a difference for Bermudians.
What made you decide that, you know, what Craig was having to offer, the OBA was having to offer, that was a good thing?
I think, like a lot of people, when the BDA and the UBP merged into the OBA, that was an exciting opportunity for Bermuda in terms of the political landscape. It was nice to see a party that was centrist, that was fiscally responsible, but still socially appropriate. It was also nice to see a party coming together that championed diversity. All of those ideas resonated with me, and it was something I wanted to get involved in.
Speaking of diversity, mm-hmm. We have the same-sex marriage case that the government is appealing to the Privy Council. What is your opinion on government appealing this?
I think it's disappointing that government feels the need to appeal this. There's only so many times you can lose in the courts. Of course, the party's mm-hmm. position, the OBA's position, the opposition's position is that we think the courts should decide this. But the courts have decided it, and the Court of Appeal for Bermuda, which is the highest court here in Bermuda, has decided the position. It's also, you know, a considerable amount of public money that's going to be spent on this appeal, and there's been some misleading statements in the press lately which indicate the costs of the government's lawyer. And of course, in Bermuda, like in England, it's a loser-pay legal system. So it's not just your own lawyer's costs, it's the costs of the other side. So I think it's a bit misleading to say, well, this is what our lawyer costs, because they're going to be having to pay the legal bills for all the other lawyers involved, at least, you know, Mr. Attride Sterling plus Mr. Pettingill. And if this goes up to the Privy Council and the government loses, there's yet more legal bills to pay. So it is considerably more expensive than the impression that's been given.
Some people have been saying, like, this is more of, has to do with politically satisfying their base. Would you feel like, you know, that's the reason for this, or do you really feel like this is a deep-rooted solid belief?
I think that there is an element of thinking in the current PLP government which recognizes the base that supports them. And I think that's regrettable. I think it's a human rights issue, ultimately. That's my own personal position.
We had the sex offenders legislation.
We did.
And you took several pointed comments, because you sat on the Junior Select Committee that was part
no,
of
No, I wasn't on the Joint Select Committee, but I led the debate on behalf of the opposition because of my role as Shadow Legal Affairs Minister. You know, it's an interesting one. I think what we can, let's start with consensus first, right? Because I think we can commend the government for having a sex offenders register. That is a good thing, and we recognize that. So in that sense, the bill was a positive first step. What was surprising is that there was a Joint Select Committee, which went through a lot of effort. And Joint Select Committee, for your viewers, you know, that's both sides. It's bipartisan. People from the opposition, people from the government. They had, I think, 10 meetings. There was about 10 or 11 of them. Some of them are senators, some of them are MPs. They sat, they considered, they reviewed the material, they looked at the science, and they came up with a list, a very detailed report, 14 various proposals. It then turned out that the bill that came to the House had been prepared before the Joint Select Committee even met, which is a bit silly. It's a bit of a waste of a time. I can't say exactly, but I think of the 14 proposals, only two of them were taken up in the bill, maybe a few more, but most of them weren't. The big points are whether or not this list should have been public or private, whether or not we should have had tiered level of offenders. That wasn't taken up as well. And that's an important issue, because if you think about it, when we think about a sex offender, you know, some people say, well, sex offender, in your mind, you think, okay, pedophile, right? Uh-huh. That's where most people go. But a sex offender could be somebody who goes skinny dipping. A sex offender could be someone who stops by the side of the road to urinate in a car and is then arrested for indecent exposure. So there are grades of sex offenders, and I think it's a regrettable miss here that the legislation didn't tackle that point and follow the recommendation of the Joint Select Committee and have tiering, because I think that would have been a sensible approach.
Yeah, so I sit in court quite often, and you know, I see a lot of people come in for sex offenses.
Yeah.
Probably a lot of that has to do with scars, mm-hmm. reaching out and make that a public issue.
Yes.
So in your mind, the, you know, somebody who's, let's say, a pedophile mm-hmm. or a rapist mm-hmm. would definitely be, you know, deserve a different ranking sort of thing.
Oh, absolutely. And it's not just my mind. This was a recommendation of the Joint Select Committee. It was a very clear recommendation. They wanted tiering. I think they wanted three tiers. And I think that makes sense because if you look at the science, you know, there is some suggestion that someone who is a pedophile isn't able to be reformed through treatment, whereas someone who is a, if I may say so, low-grade sex offender, the lower mm-hmm. tier, you know, the indecent exposure example, the voyeur, you know, that kind of person might be able to change his or her ways through treatment. That was another missed opportunity in the bill. The Joint Select Committee had recommended mandatory treatment during a prison sentence. And unfortunately, that was a missed opportunity. That wasn't included. All that was included was the fact that you would not be eligible for early parole if you failed to take up treatment in prison. So again, I think that was a missed opportunity.
So then it's just up to the offender whether or not they decide they're going to get...
An offender, absolutely, Don. Based on this bill, an offender could go to prison. An offender could refuse treatment. And at the end of his or her sentence, that offender will be released. And there's nothing that this bill has done to change that. And again, that was a recommendation. The recommendation for mandatory treatment was a recommendation of the Joint Select Committee. And again, it's a missed opportunity.
Now, I believe one of the other complaints that you had, there are many, but one of the other major complaints, at least, was that somebody who accidentally releases information or somebody releases information on somebody who's on the register, it's a $10,000
yes,
fine.
Absolutely.
And then for the offenders themselves, there's only a $3,000.
Yeah, I mean, it just doesn't seem right, and I don't think it seems... It's not common sense, is it? I mean, if someone inadvertently releases a name on the sex offender's register, which could happen, someone could leave a piece of paper on a photocopy machine, someone could leave a file on a table, that person, as the bill's drafted, is subjected to a $10,000 fine. Whereas a sex offender who is out and is subject to certain restrictions in the community, if they breach those restrictions, they were only subject to a $3,000 fine. So it just didn't seem like parity where, you know, the innocent administrative person who could make a perfectly innocent mistake is subject to up to a $10,000 fine, whereas we only had a $3,000. So we called upon the Attorney General to reconsider and to raise that $3,000 up to $10,000. So at least in the public mind, there was some parity between the convicted offender and the potentially innocent administrator.
Now, I know a lot of people in Bermuda feel like people should be named. Mm-hmm. Because they want to know to protect their children if somebody's in the neighborhood. But then the opposite view is, you know, because Bermuda is a small place,
yeah,
it makes it really difficult for the sex offender to, you know, try to shake their past.
You're absolutely right. And the Joint Select Committee wrestled with that. And they were advocating, some people on the committee were advocating for a public list. And you can see both sides, can't you? Because, you know, the risk of a public list is the risk of potentially vigilante justice. And someone says, well, okay, here is Mr. X or Mrs. X, and they're a sex offender, and they live next to me, and they're publicized. And there's repercussion. The other side of the coin, though, is you've got to think about the victims, not necessarily offenders' rights, mm-hmm. but the victims' rights. You know, what about that child? That child who lives next door to that sex offender, mm-hmm. that child has rights. So that's the argument for a public list versus a private list, or a register, mm-hmm. rather.
I guess the other concern is, like, in cases where it's incest, there's a lot of concern for the young people involved.
I mean, look, this is a very complicated area. I'm not going to suggest it's not. Mm-hmm. Some other examples are where you might have a boyfriend and girlfriend who have sex by consent, and they do so where one is a minor and one is not. Now, under the law as it currently stands, that person is technically a sex offender, which is why we thought that the tiered system, and I say we, the Joint Select Committee, thought that the tiered system would be appropriate, and the opposition endorsed that recommendation. Sadly, as I say, it wasn't taken up. The government has said that maybe some of the recommendations by the Joint Select Committee will be reviewed. We'll see. It was a shame that they weren't included in the bill.
Why don't we change part of the legislation then? In the case of, let's say, a 16-year-old and a 15-year-old or a 17-year-old and a, you know, when you shift like a, you know, within a certain number of years, it's okay.
Well, what you could do is you could revisit the definition of sex offender, which mm-hmm. is in the Criminal Code 1907. I think I may be wrong about the year, but I think it's 1907 Criminal Code. And you could revisit the definition of sex offender because, as I say, you know, the term, when uttered just common, you know, between you and me. You know, I say sex offender, and most people's minds will go to the pedophile. But this bill wasn't just about pedophilia. I mean, it dealt with rapists, but it also dealt with voyeurs or people in the example that I just gave. So, you know, as I say, this is a bit of a missed opportunity. I mean, I want to be positive. It's nice that it was done. I think the legislation was a good first step, and we commended the government for that first step. So that was a positive. It's just that they could have put a little more thought into it. They shouldn't have rushed it so quickly, and we could have had a better piece of legislation, which I think more Bermudians would have been happy with.
Also in your bailiwick here, legislation for the Child Amendment Act was pulled.
Yes.
In your opinion, you know, what should that have included to make that have stronger teeth?
Well, let's just clarify for a second. The fact that the Child Children's Act amendment was pulled doesn't mean it's not coming back. Mm-hmm. It's been delayed. It's been deferred. We're not sure yet whether it's coming back and what it's going to look like if it does come back. Now, reading between the lines, and given the public criticism that was thrown at the Attorney General and the government because of this proposed amendment, and let me just explain what the amendment is. The Children's Act, as it currently stands, provides for litigation guardians in court. And the court can, in most cases, will apply and allow a litigation guardian to look off the interest of a Bermudian child, right? The amendment is proposing, instead of having that as shall do so, the court shall appoint a litigation guardian in all circumstances, except exceptional ones when the court won't, they want to reverse it. And they want to say, in most cases, there won't be a litigation guardian, and the court may, in exceptional circumstances, have a litigation guardian. So that's the reverse position. We're effectively watering down the protection. And there was a lot of criticism of the draft bill because of that, and the opposition included in that criticism. We, you know, we don't want to see fewer rights for Bermudian children who are going through the court system, often without parents who don't have a voice. And that's what the litigation guardian is supposed to do. It's supposed to provide a voice, a watchdog, if you will, to make sure that the child's interest is protected before the courts. And so hopefully the fact that this bill was delayed, deferred, pulled, as you said, means that the government's going to have a rethink on it. And we would like to see them go back to the original position, where you have litigation guardians in all circumstances, or most circumstances, with the exception being you don't, rather than reverse it and only have them in rare circumstances. We want to see that be the norm and continue to be the norm so the children are protected.
What else do you think probably should be part of that bill?
Well, again, looking to consensus, some of the elements of the bill are positive. You know, there's going to be an overarching commission which is going to register litigation guardians. So there's going to be some discerning criteria as to who can and who should not be a litigation guardian. They're going to sort out the debates that are currently ongoing with certain litigation guardians who've been appointed but haven't been paid. So they're going to figure out what the pay structure is going to be. So again, you know, in many ways, the bill is positive. I think where the bill is negative is any effort by the government to whittle down the rights of children to be protected before the courts.
I know you weren't an active MP for the OBA when it was government, but shouldn't have the OBA have funded the litigation guardians?
Yeah, I mean, it's a fair point. This legislation is 20 years old. It goes all the way back to the former UBP government. It was one of the last pieces of legislation the UBP government put in place before they lost the election, I think in 1998, the PLP came to power. And so it is the collective fault of many governments for the past 20 years, including the OBA, I'll accept that, that litigation guardians haven't been appointed in accordance with the act as they should have done. What happened was in 2014, some caring litigation guardians and some bright lawyers came along and pointed out the section in the act to the family courts and said, look, you really need to be doing this, family court. Family court said yes. I believe the first litigation guardian appointed was Ms. Tiffany Thomas, who's been in the press recently. And thereafter, there were a series of appointments, approximately 30, possibly a few more. Where the kerfuffle came is that there wasn't any agreement, as I understand it, between the Department of Child and Family Services and Ms. Thomas as to how much she should be paid and when she should be paid, or indeed whether she should be paid. Now, that's all subject to her lawsuit against the government. I'm not going to comment further on that. But just in terms of when she chose to invoice the government, my understanding is that she rendered invoices for the first time in March 2017, so that was shortly before the OBA lost the election. So I'm not saying that excuses the OBA, but it is a collective failure, and it's something that I want to see put right.
One thing that you agree with the PLP on is the public register of beneficial ownership in Bermuda.
Right.
And it seems like one of the rare instances where everyone seems to be on the same page. Well, why do you think that is?
Well, let me just tackle that for a second. I think there are a number of instances where the PLP and the OBA or any political party are on the same page where we're looking at the collective interest of Bermuda. And when we're engaging between Bermuda and the outside world, you know, we're often very much unified, and EU substance is a recent example. In terms of the register of beneficial ownership, you know, this is something that Bermuda's had in place since the 1940s. And I look at it as a sovereignty issue, and I look at it as a privacy issue. So I think that the PLP is right on this issue, and David Burtz made his comments on the floor of the House of Assembly on this. And he's not the first. I mean, he is consistent with the previous premier and the previous premier before that and the finance minister. The logic behind it is that it is important to have a list of ownership of these companies, and it's important to know who they are. But it's not necessarily important to publish this on the front page of every paper so that everybody knows everyone's private business. You know, there is a constitutional right to privacy, and we respect that, and we think that this should be a decision that Bermuda should be allowed to take, not something that should be forced upon us by the British government.
For the average person who may not understand beneficial ownership, you know, what does that mean?
Well, beneficial ownership is just ultimately, you know, who owns a company. You know, you have a company out there, who's the owner? And it's perfectly right and proper that there should be a way to find that out. But if someone is going along doing nothing wrong and operating a company, there's no reason why that needs to be public knowledge as to who ownership, you know, your investments and what you do, what you choose to do, what your salary is. You know, these are private matters. I mean, the example is, you know, if you work for a company, you wouldn't necessarily want your coworker to know what you were getting paid. You know, there are certain elements of your financial and business life that should remain private. Now, if you're a wrongdoer, we have the register. If anybody wants to come and find out who the owner is on our register, on Bermudian's register of beneficial ownership, then they can do so. They can either do so by application to the court, or indeed, owing to a number of international treaties, they can do so by just checking with the registrar of companies. Certain other countries can do so for tax purposes.
We talked about this. You mentioned earlier about the Joint Select Committee working together. I know one of your big things is more bipartisanship.
Yes.
Why do you think this is important rather than political grandstanding?
Well, I mean, I'm a consensus person. I want to try and find solutions, and I'm happy to work with anyone to try and find those solutions. Bermuda is 21 square miles. We've got 60,000 people. We have some big problems. The idea that we need to constantly be, you know, at each other's throats and boo and yay and yes and no simply because we have two political parties, to me, doesn't make sense. So, you know, where the government is putting forward policy that I can support, I will support, and I'm you know, happy to do so. Where they put forward policy that I think is a bad idea, I'll say so. But I think it's fair to try and take some of the rancor and bitterness out of politics. I mean, people are a little sick of it, and you know, I don't think people are going to listen to what I have to say if all I'm doing is picking up rocks and throwing them all the time. I think people are more likely to listen to what I have to say if I'm fair and reasonable, and if I point out where what the government is doing is right, and where I point out what the government is doing may not be right. And I'm not saying that my opinion is always right. Sometimes it's not, but that's human nature, right?
How do you think this would help people maybe changing their minds? Because I know, like, especially like in the United States and England now, going the UK going through Brexit, people tend to be one side or the other, and it's just like nobody seems to be listening to the other side.
I would hope that almost all Bermudians can agree that we do not want to emulate what's going on in the United States and the division where it's this increasingly divided, you know, these two camps who can't find any commonality, any common ground. Many of the problems that Bermuda faces can be solved by consensus politics, in my view. You know, a lot of things we can agree on. So let's focus on what we can agree on, and let's try and solve those problems. I'm not saying we're always going to agree. You know, there are going to be differences of political ideology, and that's politics. But on a number of problems, you know, we all want to solve them. The PLP government and the MPs, they want to solve them. We want to solve them. Where we can work on them together and get something solved, we should do. As I say, I think the increasingly polar world of the United States and its political scene is not something that we Bermudians will want to follow, and I hope we don't follow.
One of the issues is the substance bill.
Yeah.
It seems like, you know, there was a report that, you know, maybe it wasn't going to meet the EU standards.
Right.
So, again, for the general public, what is this all about?
Okay, so This is a sort of Goliath versus David, or David's plural, because it doesn't just affect Bermuda, it affects other international financial centers, you know, Cayman, BVI, Channel Islands, etc. This is a circumstance where, unfortunately, the EU is dictating terms to a bunch of international financial centers, and they're saying you need to be more substantive, you have to have more presence. Now, they may be right about that, and they may be wrong about that, but the unfortunate fact is they're not applying their same rules to themselves. This is do what I say, not do what I do. And so the rules that are being dictated by the EU to these offshore international financial centers are not being dictated by the EU to Luxembourg. They're not being dictated to Liechtenstein. So there's not a level playing field. And I think if there was a commonality of substance rules across the board, if that was the global standard, I don't think that places like Bermuda and Cayman would necessarily be upset about this. It's the element of hypocrisy. It's the uneven playing field that I think it really sticks. And you know, as to that, it's an example of consensus politics locally. The opposition very much was supportive of the government on Monday when this bill went through. And the opposition is standing shoulder to shoulder with the government because we want to see Bermuda succeed. We want to see Bermuda try and face and overcome these challenges. And they are challenges. The substance requirements are challenges. It's not going to be an easy thing to work through. But Bermuda, you know, has always stepped up and it takes on adversity as best it can. And so hopefully we will continue to see business success, and we'll see both parties working together to try and ensure that happens.
Yeah, because that's another case of, you know, it's us against...
It's us against the world. It's not just us against the world. It's the EU against offshore jurisdictions or international financial centers. And if the EU's motivation was to have commonality across the board, then why not make it a global standard? Right? Why isn't the EU applying these same rules to themselves? I mean, one would expect that they should if they were really driven by concepts of fairness.
Now, I don't know if this necessarily falls underneath what you cover, but I do court quite a bit, so I cover arraignments.
Yep.
And I want to say it was the October arraignments. They had 11 people up for pleas.
Right.
None of them had an opportunity to plea because either... prosecution didn't have disclosure to defense or didn't give it to them in a timely manner.
Right.
Indictment wasn't served by the registrar in time to move things. Defense lawyers didn't disclose that they were their client's lawyer until court that morning.
Right.
And a series of other things. You know, in some cases, you know, I've seen people in court probably 6, 7, 8 times not given a plea because just basic paperwork and things,
right,
or reports haven't been done,
right,
so that they, you know, that they can proceed. How can we make our courts more efficient so that people can get a trial in a timely manner? They're not having to keep coming up in court time and time and again and not really proceeding very far.
Yeah, I mean, the wheels of justice notoriously turn slowly, and it was ever thus. And I think it's fair to say that the Attorney General's Ministry, the Legislative Affairs, is one that perhaps struggles more than others. You know, there are efficiencies that can then happen. I am not, by training, a criminal lawyer. I'm a commercial lawyer. So I tend to deal with business and commerce and property and trusts and all of that stuff. I don't really have a lot of experience in the criminal courts or in the magistrates' courts. But it is something that we need to work on and something we need to see if we can improve.
Right. Now, I know you've only been an MP for 6 months, and I don't want to try to end your political career right here on this question.
Right.
But I have to ask.
Sure.
Cassava or Farine?
Oh, there we go. Cassava.
Oh, why?
Oh, definitely. No, I also like to have it leftovers and then a little butter and then a little fry because that's really unhealthy. But there we go. That's a true Bermuda Christmas, right?
Right. Right. Well, I'm Don Burgess. I've had Scott Pearman, who's the Shadow Minister for Legal Affairs for the OB here. Thank you, Scott, for coming.
Thank you, Don. Appreciate it. And thank you, Bermuda. And best of the season to all.
Yeah. All of us from Burr News wish you a very Merry Christmas next week and Boxing Day. And we will be back after Christmas with our Facebook Live interviews. And I wish you all a very Bermudaful day.
Thanks.